listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org. If you missed any of Out FM, go to the website. In about 5 or 10 minutes, it'll all be there. Coming up next is Ecologic with Ken Gale, and you'll find out what this winter is going to be like. How wet is it going to be? How cold is it going to be?
Oh, people, people, don't you love this earth to share with everything that grows? Don't you want to taste freedom, peace in this life? I believe we can make it whole again. With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on following we could do, there's so much we could know, if we listen to the earth.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale, and this is Ecologic for November 27, 2012, here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org, where every day is Earth Day. I wrote up an eyewitness report of being here at 120 Wall Street when Hurricane Sandy's storm surge began, and it's on my website, www.comicbookradioshow.com. And if you're wondering why a show about the environment is comicbookradioshow.com, because that's a show I had from 1993 until 2007. Riverkeeper sampled the water of New York Harbor 4 days after the hurricane and found lower sewage concentrations from the combined sewer overflow than after most storms. In other words, when the surge went out at low tide, it took a lot of sewage away with it. That's an example of where the solution to pollution really was dilution. Hurricane Sandy also caused an oil spill in Woodbridge, New Jersey, when the storm lifted and ruptured a diesel storage tank. 378,000 gallons went into the Arthur Kill between New Jersey and Staten Island. Sandy also caused two other smaller tanker-sized spills. The last time there was an oil spill that big in New Jersey was about 10 years ago. For more info, go to www.nj.com. And some good news from U.S. PERG. BP pleaded guilty to felony manslaughter in the Gulf oil spill and agreed to pay $4.5 billion in its settlement with the Department of Justice. When asked if any of these penalties are tax deductible, notice the plural there, the response was, they are not. I hope that's the case. I should add, while I'm on the subject, that the impact of the leak and BP's chemical additives seems worse now than it did only a year after it happened. Further good news, this from beyondnuclear.org. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission terminated the application to build a new French nuclear reactor in Maryland. And every once in a while, I mention a bill going through Congress, Albany, or Trenton. This one is sponsored by Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, who won re-election despite hundreds of millions of dollars spent against him. It's called the 21st Century Trade Agreements Act. Ask your senators to co-sponsor it. It's an alternative to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a document well over 1,000 pages long, perhaps over 2,000, that is still being written by 600 corporate representatives. Except what's been leaked, it's seen only by corporate representatives, not even by people in Congress or the Senate. It will make environmental laws, quote, restraint of trade, unquote. It will also make indigenous rights laws restraint of trade. It will also make labor laws, generic drugs, GMO labeling, and internet freedom restraint of trade. It will even make anti-slavery laws restraint of trade. So call your senator and ask him or her to co-sponsor S-3347, the 21st Century Trade Agreements Act, instead. That's S-3347. Sometimes you say, support the 21st Century Trade Agreements Act, and they'll go, what's the bill number? So you need to know that, too. S-3347. On my website are direct links to hear past shows on the WBAI archives page. That's www.comicbookradioshow.com/eco-logic.html. Here's what you missed and when they are on. And unfortunately, the pre-Hurricane Sandy shows I did are no longer on the WBAI archives. They were in place of arts programs, which are automatically archived for only 14 days. Two Fridays ago, I was Earl Caldwell's guest on the Caldwell Chronicle and gave my eyewitness report on Hurricane Sandy. I talked about when it hit Wall Street and made environmental connections to what happened that will undoubtedly happen again. That was Friday, November 16th at 5 p.m. October 16th was 2 hours. Those domestic sources of natural gas you might hear about on commercial radio or TV are obtained mostly by fracking, a method that not only destroys water supplies, pollutes air, and lowers property values wherever it's done, but also has a high radioactive radon content. And it also has no market. The supply is greater than the demand. The mayor of New York City is pressuring landlords to convert boilers to use natural gas, also known as methane. There is pressure to convert city vehicles to methane. Political and social activists often pick an issue and focus on it, tunnel vision style, failing to connect to related issues, and some environmentalists are no exception. Fracking is a centerpiece issue among many others, from electric cars to renewable energy. Joining me for that two-hour special were Peter Ruh of Occupy Wall Street's Environmental Working Group and Donna Stein, president of New York City Friends of Clearwater. For more information about these connections, go to my website, comicbookradioshow.com/connectdotstalk.html. Monday, September 24th, from 3 to 5 p.m., I did an environmental special for Talkback. The first hour was on fracking and high-pressure pipelines. The second hour was on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I mentioned earlier. Tuesday, September 18th, was the day after the first anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. I am an active part of one of the most active working groups of Occupy Wall Street, the Environmental Solidarity Working Group, so I devoted this episode to them. My guests were four regular members of that group, and we discussed some of our actions over the past year, how they relate to the Occupy mission, and how they've affected the air, water, land, wildlife, and environmental justice. I'm a longtime activist, and the OWS Environmental Group is one of the best groups I've ever worked with. There's wonderful energy from wonderful people, and I actually look forward to the Friday evening meetings. When your air or water is clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said. This is Ken Gale for Ecologic, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org. But before I go to Time Weissmuller, I have one more report. And here to give it is Peter Ruh.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me. So,
Thanks for coming down here. The phones don't work, so you have to come all the way down here to give this report.
I know. I could be laying in bed right now.
Yeah, you could be. Wait a minute. There's like five great meetings and conferences
That's
and stuff
true.
Today.
Yeah.
But at any rate, you told me a great story about the National Guard right after Hurricane Sandy.
Just the National Guard. What happened with the storm is folks from Occupy Wall Street went out right away and started helping folks and finding out what people's needs were and knocking on doors. And the National Guard and the city and the Red Cross came in a little bit later and in some cases way later. And What you want to do on the ground in those kind of situations is talk to people that know what's going on. So the National Guard, in many cases, has been receiving has received orientations from Occupy Sandy activists that are have been dispatching volunteers to numerous relief hubs around the city. And I mean, I've even seen Girl Scouts get this orientation, which is basically, you know, it includes very practical advice about, you know, safety and what to wear when you're going out into these regions hit by Sandy. But also, you know, it's an anti-oppression training a la Occupy Wall Street. So it's been pretty amazing to see these soldiers getting that from Occupy. And just amazing overall has been this amazing grassroots relief effort that Occupy Wall Street has launched. It's turned the organizing that was happening on a small plot of land, albeit some of the most valuable real estate in the world, outward across the whole city and picked up where the state has really failed. And it's continuing to fail. In fact, right before I entered the studio, I received an email about a young mother in the Rockaways that was living in an apartment that had been foreclosed on, apartment covering, you know, increasingly mold growing in this apartment, living there with her two small children, mold taking over the baby carriage, and someone going in there to help her and taking her to a city, quote, restoration center, and being there for 3 hours with two small children, and in the end getting nothing but a $300 Salvation Army grocery check. And, you know, this woman's obviously afraid to leave her home because she might lose it. So this is the kind of response that's very inadequate that we're seeing from the city so far. And it's amazing and it's outrageous that we have this billionaire mayor and this is what we're seeing. We can't get relief to folks. But on the other hand, people are organizing. And this morning I was at a press conference with residents from Red Hook who have been coming together and are putting demands in the New York City Housing Authority, and they're calling for the rent for November and December to be forgiven. NYCHA was largely absent throughout the storm, except when they showed up to put rent notices on people's doors. Mm-hmm. So people got together and they said, no, no, thank you. And there have been residents in Red Hook that said, I've been trying to get up, you know, sit at the table with NYCHA for years, and this is the first time they've listened. So things are going to change. Another incredible thing that I've seen come out of the storm is that the YANA, it was a worker trainer center. YANA stands for You Are Never Alone. And it was a worker training center set up right before the storm that was inundated with floodwaters, shut down, and reopened as a recovery center. And now Winnie Wong, for instance, from OWS Sustainability, and some of those activists are now renovating that building and installing copper pennies on the floor to trap heat, cleaning the walls of mold. And Greenpeace has been on that site, you know, since the very beginning, providing power through solar energy. So that's some of the incredible things that might be a model. And just one more thing is listeners should be aware that there's the threat that they're going to start burning some of this rubble at, I think it's Floyd Bennett Field in Brooklyn, just burning it, you know, in an open field. And there's also certain threats of environmental contamination, not just from mold, but in Red Hook, for instance, the floodwaters pass through, like, cement processing plants, fuel loading plants, and we need to be putting pressure on the EPA to do some real testing. They could have tested the waters when they had the chance, and they did not. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so if you, folks are interested in more information, they should go to interoccupy.net. Interoccupy.net/Occupy Sandy. And you'll find all kinds of information from, like, what you could donate and where you can go to help out.
Now I heard that there were 5,000 people from Occupy that were volunteering all over
the city. No, it's been, like, I would say at least 10,000 people. Maybe
because one of the producers here was very angry when I said that. She said, like, oh, I hardly ever see anybody from Occupy out there.
Well, the incredible thing is there's been a sort of, remember after the raid, people were like, well, Occupy has no roots. Well, but that was largely true. Like, Occupy really did struggle to grow some roots outside of Zuccotti Park. And the way that people have stepped in with this storm, they've connected with community groups all across the city, and they've been working hand in hand. And rather than be splintered by the storm, and the thing that, you know, it's going to really, you know, if we're going to be building a sustainable recovery, if we're going to be building a recovery that provides prevailing wage jobs to people, we're all going to have to band together. So it's not just Red Hook, not just Rockaway's out there fighting for Rockaway's, fighting for Red Hook, but we're all in the here fighting for our city and fighting together. And there's a real potential for that right now.
All right, thanks, Pete. And now the meat and potatoes of the show. That was the appetizer. Tom Weissmuller, you may remember, if you were listening to BAI right before Hurricane Sandy hit, you heard Tom Weissmuller on the air a couple times that day explaining what was going on with Sandy. So give us a little bit of that right now. What the heck happened?
Well, we had a hurricane that made a very sharp left turn. And the interesting, a couple of interesting, first of all, hurricanes are unusual weather events. And this one was unusual. Each one is unique. This hurricane managed to stay over the warm Gulf Stream for most of its life. And that actually allowed it to retain strength that it might have lost had it moved off the warm Gulf Stream waters. So the hurricane was a little bit more powerful than it should have been. And then it speeded up. When it made that left turn, it actually increased in speed. It was moving around 16 to 18 miles an hour. By the time it hit land, it was moving over 30 miles an hour. And when a hurricane...
What makes a hurricane speed up like that?
First of all, the closer it got to the New York, New England area, there was this massive high-pressure system that was off the coast of New England for days. And this high-pressure system slowly pushed water toward New York, into Long Island Sound, into New York Bay. In and of itself, it just would have been noticed that, yes, the tide would have been a little bit higher. We also had spring tides because the moon and the earth were lined up. So you had a couple of things that were adding water to the zone. But the closer the hurricane got to the high, the more it fell under the influence of it. And the high-pressure system, when it's off the New England coast, the winds are all out of the east. And you move that hurricane closer into it, and it literally pushed it right onto land and accelerated its velocity. And since a hurricane's winds circulate around it, in this case counterclockwise, the northern edge of the hurricane, the winds were around 70 miles an hour around the hurricane itself, actually a little bit strong, about 80 miles an hour. But you have to add the 30 mile an hour forward motion of that hurricane to those 80 mile an hour winds. So In places like Toms River, you actually had hurricane winds that were approaching 115, 118 miles an hour, even though the basic hurricane winds were 75 and 80 miles an hour. So they got unusually hard hit by the storm, and the results showed.
Yeah, you mentioned that everybody north of the hurricane would get that extra winds.
The hurricane's wind force dissipates from distance from the eye. All right, so if you're 60 miles, 80 miles away from the eye, you're not dealing with 80 mile an hour winds anymore. Now you're only dealing with 70. But 70 and 30 is still 100. So you still have strong winds coming in on land. And basically what it did is it pushed a wall of water into New York Bay, into Long Island Sound. Now, we were lucky in a sense, and lucky is maybe the wrong word, but the hurricane, because it speeded up, did not hit landfall at precisely high tide. It actually hit land about 2 hours earlier. So we had a 13.5-foot surge in New York Harbor. We might have had a 16-foot surge had the hurricane retained its original speed and the landfall coinciding with high tide. And by the way, when a hurricane is over water, hurricanes are tremendous low-pressure cells. And this particular hurricane had a very wide low-pressure cell. And what happens then
is huge.
Yes, it actually lifts the ocean up, like a vacuum cleaner almost. So it adds to the storm surge, adds to the tidal forces. So we really got hit by this storm because of the way it turned into land. And by the way, it went all the way into West Virginia and dumped all kinds of snow on West Virginia. It wasn't just finished with us in the East Coast here.
Yeah, one of my friends who has a brother in Virginia, a brother in Pittsburgh, and a sister in Rhode Island said, all my relatives were affected by the same storm. That's never happened before.
Well, again, it's an unusual storm track, and it's because of that blocking high. The meteorologists call it an omega block because it looks like the Greek letter omega. I mean, you just have this lump sitting off the coast. And the high then moved off. And the hurricane almost went around it. It went into Canada. But once it's over land, doesn't have access to warm Gulf water anymore, the loss of moisture changes the hurricane from a hurricane, which is fueled by evaporating water from the ocean, into a nor'easter, which is basically a wind circulating storm, which pulls off moisture off the ocean, but doesn't really get a lot of fuel to it. Once it's inland, it was still a powerful storm, still dragged down a lot of cold air from lower Canada into the United States, and that was cold air, and that's why you got all that snow.
It was a tremendous thing to watch. I was looking out the window here at 120 Wall Street, seeing the water hit, and seeing it rising higher and higher. It submerged traffic lights on the corner here, which to me is a lot more than 12 feet.
One of the things that's good about storms, if there is such a thing, is that your planning for the future can be altered and needs to be altered. And you know, the New York City planning documents that predated the storm had the highest expected surge in a 500-year storm at about 12 feet. And, you know, so, duh, this one was 13 feet. When we had the hurricane of 38 hit, by the way, in 1938, we had a Category 3 storm hit. And that, in Narragansett, that storm, the peak gusts were recorded at 180 miles an hour, not 80 miles an hour. And again, that had a tremendous forward motion, almost 45 miles an hour, added to the Category 3 strength of the storm. And the only reason we know it was 180 is because that was the speed at which the anemometer, the wind speed gauge, was blown off the pole that measured it. So it might even have been higher. Providence, Rhode Island had a 20-foot storm surge. The entire downtown was
38.
Flooded. Yes, the hurricane of 38. And the buildings still have marks on them. I guess the question I had is why the New York City planning kept theirs at around 12 and a half feet for their surge. They weren't exempt. By the way, I feel
there's
really
a lot
good
of denial going on in the New York City government.
No. Hang on a second. This is the nice part about it. Last week, I was at American Bar Association presentation about planning for storms in New York, and the new slide for New York City had the expected max surge at 25 feet. So it was done very quickly. This you learned, and you do this without rancor, without recrimination. You don't say, you didn't plan right. You say, look, we know more now. We're going to plan better for the future. And in the New York Times today, there was an article about these bladders that they want to put in the subways in case for future flooding, that they've been working on these systems. So, you know, the good thing is you learn from some of these things, right, and you plan better for the future.
Well, there was a meeting of the New York Solar Energy Society a few weeks ago, and it's amazing how many people in government are contacting solar people now. The very people who were like, no, everything has got to be, you know, natural gas, are starting to realize that with natural gas being part of the problem of climate change, you better have an alternative. And we've been screaming renewable energy for, you know, 20 years or 30 years, and they're finally listening. How, whether that listening will translate into policy, I don't know. On the next episode of Ecologic, I'll be exploring that topic.
Your solar show should be quite interesting.
I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm at this meeting, and and getting more and more interested in what people were saying about what was developing in Albany and in New York City and in Trenton and even in Washington. And at one point, we were talking about the price of solar, and it's like, I wish there was math on it. And then somebody hands me a document that math has been done. And so I'm like, you know what? We're doing an episode of Ecologic. All you people here at this meeting are going to come on the radio, and they all agreed to. So this week we're talking with Tom about problems, and then in 2 weeks we'll be talking about solutions. So, okay, so that's what happened, you know, a month ago with Hurricane Sandy. For the last 3 years, Tom Weissmuller here has accurately predicted how cold and how wet the winter was going to be. And how that coldness and wetness would be in the form of snow, in the form of rain. And you've been right 3 years in a row, so now you have to be right 4 years in a row. So what's going on?
Well, this, unfortunately, it's a tough act to follow, Ken. You know, what I try to do...
You make it tough for every year by being right.
Well, I try to explain the basis for the forecast.
Right.
I've done that in the last couple of years, and your shows are these shows are archived. So if you want to find out the relationship between El Niño, La Niña, and how one forms and the other, you can actually get them on the archives. And I think I have some of them on my my website, too, which is colderside.com. And but let me, again, you know, the fascinating thing about meteorology is that things always change. And it turns out that the forecast I have for this particular winter is going to be different from the last three. And there are reasons for it. And I'm going to start in an area that most people don't even think affects our weather here, but it's the our North Pole. And to those of you who've been reading the papers or listening, you've realized that this particular year, 2012, we had a record open Arctic Ocean in September. Now, why is that important? The Arctic, for years and years, was sealed shut with floating ice. When you have ice on water, you don't get a lot of moisture getting through the ice, and it tends to be very, very dry. Well, we were losing about 100,000 square kilometers.
You're talking about the winds going over that area.
Yes, that's
part of weather patterns.
Any wind over ice doesn't pick up a lot of moisture. Now, we were losing for the last 15 years, every year, about 100,000 square kilometers of ice every year. In 2007, in 1 year, we lost 1 million.
Give us a picture. What's 100,000
well,
square kilometers?
Well, a kilometer is 6/10 of a mile. So you have to think of a square, 6/10 of a mile square.
Right, and say 600.
That's 1 kilometer, okay?
Right.
Now, 100,000 of those is an area which is probably about as big as most of New England. So it's a good chunk. But 1 million can cover not only New England, but most of eastern Canada. And we lost that much ice in 2007. It was a record open Arctic. What happened in 2008, we had record snow cover on top of the planet. And that's because of what we call lake effect or ocean effect snow. If you have open water and cold wind blowing over the open water, it will pick up moisture and then dump it as snow on the shore.
Now, why do you say 2008?
Right. Well, that was the year after 2007's open Arctic. And the open Arctic allowed that moisture to get picked up, deposited on Asia, on Canada, North America. So what remained
was... So you expect that to happen again?
Well, it already has. And I'll describe what happened this particular winter. In this winter, we had even more open Arctic. By the way, when you have that much snow on the ground, sunlight bouncing off it removes energy, basically, from the Earth. And in 2008... The
you
summer,
mean sunlight bouncing off
okay.
it.
Okay. When you have an open snow... okay, let me start with open land. Sunlight hits land, dirt, trees, converts this shortwave radiation to longwave radiation, which we call infrared. And infrared is wonderfully heat-trapped by carbon dioxide, by water vapor, by the heat-trapping gases. And it's re-radiated back to Earth, and that's why we call CO2 a heat-trapping gas.
So think about a car in the summertime.
Well,
sunlight goes through the window and heats up the car.
That's correct. And the window in this case is the atmosphere. Hits, let's say, the dashboard of the car. Dashboard gets hot and does not escape the car itself. The analogy breaks down a little bit. But the atmosphere is like that window if you have open ground. Now, if you have open snow and cloud, and they both reflect almost equally, the sunlight coming in does not convert to longer wave infrared, which gets trapped by CO2. It gets bounced off at the same wavelengths it comes in. The reason snow is white is because it equally reflects all wavelengths of light, and so we see all the colors in the rainbow reflected as white. But the shortwave radiation pierces the CO2 on the way up the same way it does on the way in. In effect, when you have, and we've had for this fall, we have almost all of Asia covered by snow, the effect of CO2 over that part of the world is down in the 300 parts per million area, not the 395 that we have over the entire planet. Now, it's only the part that's over the snow, because the solar energy coming in, 70% bounces out and goes right off the planet and doesn't come back. So it gets colder. Now, that's what's happened this winter. We had an open Arctic in September, hugely open. Every year, the northern jet stream slowly collapses around the pole, and the low-pressure systems that form on it literally can sweep moisture off the Arctic Ocean, deposited as snow. Now, by mid-November, the Arctic had already frozen back over. You had maybe 1 or 2 feet of new ice, but it sealed. But the damage was already done. If you look from space at Asia, it is covered in snow all the way down to the Himalayas. Northern Canada, much more snow than usual. It's called albedo. Albedo is reflectivity. And
spell albedo for us.
A-L-B-E-D-O.
Because people are looking it up on the internet now.
I hope they are, because that's the way you learn some things. Now,
A-L-B-E-D-O.
Yeah. Asia is much colder. Last week, there were some articles about Pakistan getting record snow when they shouldn't have had it, earlier snow. Why? Because the air that came down over Asia was already cooled because of all the energy that never even reached the ground and never stayed on the earth. You tend to have high pressure forming when that happens, and that high pressure spills over into the northern Pacific and pushes a weather system that almost every year forms off the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. It's called the Aleutian Low. It's almost a permanent meteorological fixture, but that high pressure system, the same way Hurricane Sandy got pushed over land, that high pressure system pushes that Aleutian Low further to the east. Normally in Anchorage, Alaska,
around so high pressure winds bully low pressure.
Yeah, kind of, yes. And low pressure always tries to get into high pressure, and that's why on the border zone between low pressure systems and high pressure systems, you have fairly high wind speeds. Those high wind speeds usually drag air off of Hawaii and bring it right into central Alaska. They call it the Pineapple Express. And you can get 70-mile-an-hour winds in the Cook Inlet just from that low-pressure cell that's over the Aleutians. But it's not there this year. It's further to the east. Those winds are now coming in over the Rockies and the side of the Canada. And Canada now has a fair amount of snow in the interior that it probably shouldn't have had. But because of that moisture being dragged into Canada. Here's the effect on our winter weather, and I'm going to try to get to it quickly. Last year we had a La Nina system, and I described how La Nina forms when you have clouds over the Pacific. You have the equatorial Pacific cooling because of evaporation. The clouds usually are thunderstorms, a lot of vertical development in them. They pick moisture up off the ocean. That cools the ocean too. When you have a cooler equatorial Pacific, and the contrast between the Pacific equator and the pole is less. You have less wind between them, and the jet stream flattens out. And last year we had a flat jet stream that just crossed the country, very little undulation in that jet stream. Well, when you have El Nino, the opposite, meaning a warmer Pacific, no clouds, total absorption.
So, because of La Nina, the snow from northern Canada stayed in northern Canada.
Right, and this,
it didn't
and,
come
and
down
this,
here.
And the moisture that would have been picked up in Texas and dragged up the East Coast never had a way to get up the East Coast because the jet stream didn't carry it there. Things are a little bit different. Now, uniquely, we have both. How can you have both La Nina and El Nino? Well, it turns out that somebody at NOAA, a brilliant person, and I wish I could take
credit
for it.
The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration.
Right. In the old days, we used to call it the Weather Bureau. But somebody came up with a description. Instead of El Nino and La Nina, he said, well, now we have La Nada, which is kind of in between. And it turns out that off the coast of Australia, we have a full-blown El Nino, and off the coast of Peru, we have La Nina. So we have the Pacific Ocean is almost split in with both. We don't have a full El Nino, which means part of the Pacific Ocean does not have that high temperature contrast, but part of it does. And what I expect to see this winter is this combination that we actually had this past week. Those of you in the New York, New England area, remember that we had nice warm temperatures toward the end of last week, almost reaching the 60-degree level, and in fact, in some cases, exceeding it. And then we had a cold front sweep through, and a fairly good blast of cold air, and now a coastal storm forms here, and we're getting a mix of rain and snow because of that cold air that's been dragged down. It's a fairly high temperature contrast, meaning from warm to cool, and I think we're going to see that undulation most of this winter. Not the severe contrast of an El Nino, but you'll have a mild period, cold front sweep through, about a week or so later, a snowstorm will develop, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, again, a mild push of air. The chances of having what we call a January thaw are quite high this year. Last year, we didn't really have a thaw, but we never had it really cold either.
Yeah, there was nothing to thaw last
year.
Right,
and there was no snow on the ground. And by the way, again, when there's no snow on the ground, the sunlight gets absorbed and continues warming it. We're going to see snow this winter. We're not going to see the snows of 2 inches ago. I don't know if you remember, 2 inches ago we were in the studio. We had finished our forecast, and the two of us kind of trudged in 3 or 4 inches of snow heading back up. And I had my car down here, and I finally made it back to Maine that same night. I actually outraced the storm. The next day there was 13 inches of snow on the ground.
Yeah, I remember being there. I'm sitting in the front seat watching the snow hit the car, and you're looking at it, judging how many inches per hour of that snow it was based on the size of the flakes and their right. speed and things like that. And I remember thinking that this is not going to be the average car ride up town.
Well, no, you got home safely, and I did too. And I chose my route based on where the snow was going and where I knew it was going to be falling. This winter,
which every driver should be able to do.
Well, not all of them went to NYU and took all the meteorology courses, you know. So it's a little bit different. So we're going to.
Oh, and I should mention because you mentioned NOAA, NOAA.gov is their website.
Right.
If you're looking at NOAA.org or .com, you're not going to find it. NOAA.gov, and you can put in your zip code to get weather predictions for the next several days.
Yeah, and the .gov means it is a governmental agency, yeah. So that you're getting basically the official word of the U.S. government. It's a lot of good meteorological information on there, and a lot of other weather websites, too. one of my favorites is What's Up With That? This guy is by the name of Watt, W-A-T-T. And he has climate information and meteorological information. And on the sidebar of that website, you have a whole string of information about weather. You have weather maps. You have temperature maps. You have an El Nino, La Nina page. You have a sea ice page, sea ice reference page. And that's fascinating because, again, this year we had record open Arctic,
yeah.
And you can see how far down below the old average this year's was. And by the way, it's caught up, and the Arctic is now, once we get close to Christmas time now, the Arctic Ocean is in total darkness. So all it can do is get cold. The only warmth coming in the Arctic are the ocean currents that are still coming into the Arctic, but the sunlight's gone, and the Arctic stays frozen, and it will stay frozen until sometime in the summer when it begins to break up again. One of the reasons we had breakup this year that was so much of a record is that in the middle of August, we had a storm that actually entered part of the Arctic Ocean. The ice has been so thin that it's what we call frangible ice, meaning it's easy to break up. If you have ice that's only a foot or two thick and you have wave action, the ice can break up. When it breaks up, its surface area increases, its ability to melt increases, and that storm actually hastened the annual melt of the ice so that we had the record open Arctic. Now, because of the albedo effect and the snow that's been deposited over all of Northern Asia and North America, and we'll have more in North America, we will lose so much energy coming in from the sun that next summer the Arctic will not be as open. However, it will still be thin ice. So a couple of years from now, we're going to get even more of a record open Arctic. The die is cast. There is, in my view, all right, and this is just my own opinion, but this is shared by other people too, there is nothing that we can do to stop this gradual melt of the Arctic Ocean. And the more the Arctic is open, the more of that snow that will be swept over Asia and Europe. Northern England is having a very cold week right now this week, colder than usual at this time of year for the same reasons. Mm. You know, all of our CO2 curtailment efforts are a little drop in the bucket. We will not have the impact that we'd like to believe we can have. This die has been cast a long time ago.
Well, if there's 150 years of the, or 200 years of the Industrial Revolution, we're not going to undo it in a couple of years.
That's right.
The decision makers don't want to undo it at all.
The point I'm trying to make is that we need to plan for the effect of a gradually open Arctic. It will affect the planet's weather. One of the effects has been that for the last 15 or 16 years, the temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere have basically been in a flat line. They've been high. So, in other words, we have emerged from the little ice age and started, I think, 1998 was probably one of the warmest years we ever had. And the temperature has stayed at that level, but they have not gone up any higher because of that albedo effect. And the more the Arctic is going to be open, the more that's going to be happening. Temperatures are still going to be bouncing around flat as a pancake across the chart, even as CO2 continues to rise.
Oh, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org. I'm speaking with Tom Weissmuller, who's been a meteorologist. He's worked for NASA and has been predicting accurately the upcoming winter and spring for the last 3 years. So you get a chance to hear him do it again. The first time he did that, I was at Arisia with him in Boston in January, and he was explaining what the winter and spring were going to be like, and he was right. And I'm going, you got to do this on the air. You know, it's one thing for me to say, come on the air in the spring and say that you were right. It's another thing for the listeners to hear you be right in the beginning of the winter. And it's become an annual tradition here on Ecologic, and one I kind of enjoy continuing.
And well, I enjoy coming back, Ken, so I appreciate the opportunity to describe how each winter is different and why it's different. And, you know, a couple of years ago, the open polar sea never had any impact on our weather, but now it does. So things are continually changing.
Now, what about the glaciers? I've been hearing about record icebergs coming out of the glaciers of both Greenland and Antarctica.
The edges of Greenland are, the word is ablating ice at a record pace, particularly the western edges. You basically have glaciers which are moving to the ocean. They are leaving their icebergs as they enter the ocean.
The glaciers like a river of ice.
Right, and they are ice rivers. However, the interior of Greenland in the last couple of years has been gaining ice. Now, why would that happen? Well, if you have a record open Arctic, and all of a sudden you have open water on the eastern side of Greenland, and Greenland is at the latitude where the atmosphere of the Earth literally rotates. The Earth is rotating underneath its own atmosphere. So anywhere you stand in northern Greenland, the wind is always out of the east. They're called the polar easterlies because the Earth is rotating from west to east. The atmosphere doesn't move as fast. So you have this easterly wind. Well, that easterly wind is now picking water up off the open Arctic Ocean on the eastern side of Greenland and putting it out to Greenland. There's a summit
stage. Is that speeding up the glaciers?
It probably will add to the speed of the glaciers, but only as the ice itself increases. We have a research station around 10,000 feet up in Greenland. It's called a summit station. If you Google it, you'll probably get pictures of it. They build a darn thing on stilts because they have to keep on raising it because so much snow falls that they have to keep on top of the snow. They've been getting a lot of snow. There's a webcam up there, by the way. Now, of course, now it's dark, so that doesn't help you a lot. But in the summer and in the fall, you could actually see it snow, and you could see the difference in height as the snow fell. We had actually, Greenland had a blob of warm air come up from the United States over Greenland. I think it was like the first week in August. And it actually raised the temperature above freezing for most of Greenland. Like it was 32, 33, 34 degrees. And we had a layer of that ice and snow melt over the entirety of Greenland. So neat graphic in the New York Times about it. 2 weeks later, one of these storms came over and put 2 feet of snow over the same area. And snow, of course, is like almost a 20-to-1 ratio between snow depth and ice depth. So you'd need about 2 feet of snow to get you back that 1 inch that you lost when it melted.
I spoke to an Arctic climatologist a few years ago who was showing pictures of glacier movement. And the way they measure glacier movement, they just put sticks, vertical sticks, across the glacier. And they have one on the shore of the glacier, so to speak. And then they just measure the sticks moving down this river of ice as it flows toward the ocean. And he showed me a 1 month, photograph of the same glacier, and the sticks had moved. And the first thing I noticed is that the sticks didn't move evenly.
That's right.
You know, you think of a river of ice. Well, a river, all the water is moving downriver at the same speed.
In a glacier,
faster. The sticks were not moving, so it was instead of a straight line that when they set the sticks up, it was now a jagged line.
Right. That, by the way, the line is jagged for lots of reasons. The center of the ice river will move faster than the edges, and the ground underneath the glacier impacts it the same way that a standing wave does in a springtime in rapids in a river. Have you ever seen these guys kayaking down a river? You have these standing waves. Well, you don't have a standing wave in ice, but you have the slowing of the glacier and speeding up of the glacier. By the way, I haven't seen this movie. It's been recommended to me. It's called Chasing Ice, and it is playing in the area here. And what these fellows did in the Chasing Ice movie is they set up cameras on time-lapse, and they have time-lapse pictures of glaciers and ice movement. I haven't seen it yet, but I understand it is visually stunning.
Somebody recommended to me this past weekend.
Good for you. Good. The word is spreading.
The word is certainly spreading.
I'm definitely going to see it in the next week.
But anyway, what this Arctic climate challenge was just showing me is that glaciers are moving faster, that the amount that these sticks had moved in 1 month would have taken an entire year to move a few years earlier. And he was saying this like, you know, he'd been repeating it over and over again all day at this demonstration. But there was this emotion in his voice that I wasn't used to hearing in scientists.
Well, you get excited about things. I get excited about meteorology too.
He wasn't excited and like, isn't that cool? He was excited, isn't this scary? Yeah. because, you know, as far as he's concerned, glaciers aren't supposed to move that quickly. And ice is not supposed to move from the land to the ocean as quickly as it was.
By the way, Ken, they vary. So some years the glaciers run like crazy, and then two or three years they will go slow again and then speed up. And again, it depends, like you said before, on the ice buildup behind it. Because the ice that accumulates on top of Greenland pushes down and forces the ice off the edges. Now, most of the glaciers...
But also the how fast it moves off of land.
Right.
Because I was wondering, you know, why the icebergs that came off of Greenland, I mean, they were huge, you know, the size of Manhattan and things like that.
Keep in mind, one of them sunk the Titanic, right?
But what they were saying, there was so much publicity about these particular icebergs and how big they were. And I'm thinking, are they the biggest? And I looked it up. No, they weren't. And so doing a little more digging, I found out, well, no, they weren't the biggest, but they were the most influential. Because the icebergs of a few years ago, which were larger, didn't move away from Greenland as quickly. And when these from this summer moved away from Greenland quickly, that meant the glacier behind them could move more quickly. So the ice was flowing faster. And that's why these glaciers this summer were more influential, not just because of their size, but how fast they moved from the shore of Greenland and into the ocean.
Yeah, but keep in mind, the edges of Greenland and the source of these glacial rivers extends about 15 to 20 miles into Greenland. And Greenland is hundreds of miles across. Mm. So you have much more surface area in the center of Greenland to accumulate the new snow that's falling on there than these relatively thin rivers, which in some areas are gushing out into the oceans, but in other areas, not a lot of movement.
That's right, because they talked about water from underneath.
Yes.
Which helps
the glacier move. It slides a little bit better. And, you know, glaciers create friction, too, when they go over the ground. And if they move fast, they create more friction, which heats the water, builds up that little ice layer. There's some scientists at NYU who do a number of studies on these glaciers, and once in a while I get to talk to them, and that makes me feel pretty good too, being an NYU alumnus and things like that. So there's really good research being done in New York. Columbia has its Lamont Earth Observatory. Yeah. Across the Hudson and the Palisades, to do a fair amount of climate research there. I don't always agree with those guys because I approach it from a meteorological standpoint, and they have maybe a broader view of things. But it's okay. It's neat to talk to people, to show that you do have differences and that you have areas of agreement. But you know, meteorologically, for this winter, we're going to have an interesting winter. We're going to have the warm periods that we usually don't get interlaced with snow periods. I think we have a higher chance.
Now, will those warm periods melt the snow, so now that the snow is going to last long?
They'll melt them a little bit easier. In January, it's tough to melt snow because the sun angle is so low, and the sun is up for such a short period of the day that it's tougher. In March and April, you can melt snow a lot quicker. We'll have a higher chance of a white Christmas than we had last year. Last year, I said we were almost going to have no chance of a white Christmas. This year, I said...
Notice that Tom didn't guarantee a white Christmas. He said a higher chance of a white Christmas.
Yeah, I'd love to be able to guarantee it. But I do think we have a good shot at a white Christmas this year. Meaning, there'll be snow on the ground during Christmas. And that'll make people feel pretty good because they've missed it last year. The year before, they had it, though.
Yeah, so, before they had more than they wanted.
Yeah, and not everybody likes to shovel albedo, which is exactly what you do when you shovel the snow. Yeah.
So yeah, look up albedo on the internet or in a paper dictionary, albedo. Yeah. And so you're saying that this warm and then cold and then warm and then cold will be about a week on, a week off.
Yeah, I think maybe over two weeks on and off. Weather systems tend to move relatively slowly if you don't have that high temperature contrast between the equator and the poles. They don't go as fast. So it'll be cold, it'll stay cold for a few days, then it'll gradually warm up, and then we'll get another shot of cold. And so a lot of times a coastal low will form when one of those cold fronts comes through. If we're lucky and we get a cold front that gets all the way down to Texas, they will get some needed moisture. We've had what would you call a northward migration of the horse latitudes because the planet is getting warmer. The oceans are getting warmer. There's about a 1,000-to-1 ratio between the heat content of the oceans and the atmosphere. But most people, we live in the atmosphere, so we're looking for atmospheric differences. Mm-hmm. But the sea surface temperatures have had a steady rise over the years, which is continuing, and that has moved the high pressure zone that's usually around 30 degrees latitude a little bit further north into Texas, helping to create drought conditions there. But if we had these coastal storms form in the Gulf, Texas will get some needed moisture. Those storms will track up the East Coast, and we'll have, like I say, interesting weather and a lot of high employment opportunities for meteorologists.
Now, the El Nino, is that Australia or Peru?
It's on the Australian side is the El Nino. There's a warming of the Pacific near Australia.
So the La Nina is near Peru.
Yeah, and nearer to us.
And so that's what's cooling down the equator.
Right. And that's why we're not going to get as severe temperature contrasts as we would with big snowstorms coming up the East Coast.
You know? So the southern hemisphere is going to get large.
The southern hemisphere, the southern hemisphere is mainly ocean. There's a lot less temperature contrast in the southern hemisphere than there is in the northern hemisphere. Here we have a lot of land. And when you have a lot of land and snow on the land reflecting sunlight, it gets much, much colder. The oceans in the southern hemisphere and South America, they get cold winters, but not nearly as cold as we get up here because you don't have that large surface area. Oceans spread their heat content over a large part of the Earth. There are parts of the Earth, if you look at it from space, like south of the equator in the Pacific Ocean, where you can look down, you just don't see land. I mean, it's just all water, even temperature water.
Give us your website again.
Colderside.com. I need to update it with this forecast, and I will in about a week or so. But I'm traveling. I'm not near home. I live up in Maine. I've got to get back to where I live, and I can work on my computer.
So you'll be able to hear a couple old episodes of Ecologic on that website.
Yeah, they're actually on there right now. If you go to the media page, I think I have at least two of your broadcasts on there. I don't have the hurricane broadcasts, which I really would like.
They vanished so quickly.
If they could resurrect them here, that would be great, Ken.
I suppose I should put out a call to the listeners of Ecologic. If anybody happened to tape or download when Tom Weissmuller was on WBAI on the day of the hurricane, please email me at nuffsaid@riseup.net. And we'll have to get a copy of Tom's shows to Tom. So thank you, Peter Ruve, Occupy Wall Street's Environmental Solidarity Working Group.
Oh, yeah, and thank you, Tom. I was so silent because my mouth was just aghast. I was learning so much. It was incredible. And I just want to...
That's a compliment. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate that.
And I just want to tell listeners, if they're interested, again, to go to interoccupy.net/OccupySandy to get involved. And if people are interested in learning more about some of the political and social developments coming out of the storm, my latest piece is Struggles New and Old Emerge in Sandy's Wake, and it's available at wagingnonviolence.org and at other sites. So just Google that and check it out.
Wagingnonviolence.org. Okay, and I'll go out with a sort of a holiday song and a precursor to the show I'm doing in 2 weeks. And this is Bright Morning Star.
One, two, three, four. See the sun, how bright it shines on the nations of the earth. All who share this thing called life celebrate each day's rebirth. So solar power, inexpensive energy. So solar power, inexpensive energy.
sweetly singing o'er the plain, and the windmills in reply, echoing this glad refrain. So solar power, inexpensive energy. Brother River, do you hear how the valley calls you down? Bend your rushing waters near, make the joyful hills resound. So
inexpensive energy, so